I understand we will not have a presentation from SAMDA today because we wanted the minister and the deputy minister to be in this meeting, but none of them is available. We will call them whenever they are available and then appear. So we leave that agenda item out for today, and then we will deal with the Department of Defense presentation on military court case administration and the departmental legislative program. I take it that you are going to do this presentation, Sagdev?
Yes, we'll be doing
that. Okay, over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honorable Member of the Committee. We'd like to start by introducing our team. They were just introduced from where they are sitting. My name is Sam Kulube. I'm the Secretary of Defense.
My name is Raji Piero.
Good morning. My name is Simkiwe Jamani Kosana, the legal advisor to the Office of Protection.
Today I'm Colonel Heinz Schmidt from the Legal Services Division, Senior Staff Officer, Military Justice.
Thank you very much. Do you also want us to introduce ourselves?
No.
Okay.
Open.
Our two post presentations is okay, Honorable Chairperson, together. I would imagine that the both presentations put together both on the military court cases as well as our policies, our military justice team, as well as our policy development shouldn't take more than 20 minutes, but it could be two presentations that we just to see whether our systems are working because what is on the level of the launch. We have circulated. Okay, we have circulated the presentation, so we will be focusing on the what is now circulated. We have received a request from the committee for the Department of Defense, the Special Defense Legal Services, to brief the committee on matters relating to this military court case administration, and as well as, of course, to review and the condition of certain policies and possible tabling of legislation. The military court cases within the Department of Defense is actually accountable to the defense. The aim of this presentation is to give the portfolio committee a question, and the scope will just cover mostly the system of military justice administration and then go to the legislative program. And now, when I'm now looking at slide number 5. Just to make sure that we correct really the gist of the presentation. Where we are reporting from April, because we thought that rather than to, since we were not given guidelines as to what period we should cover, we thought that since this is already a half year for this financial year, we will report on the progress or status over the past 6 months of this financial year, from April to August, and then saying, let's look at the cases, how many cases were outstanding when we started this financial year, and after 6 months, how many cases are still outstanding, and how were the cases managed on a monthly basis. Now, I would like to inform the members that our military court system is made up, when it's fully functional, we would like to have 40 judges, 4-0, when it's fully functional. And there we have had challenges, especially over the past year and a half or so, in terms of the filling up of this post of the judges because of changes that we were doing following the our revision of the military discipline bill, which covers the issue of court cases, and also looking into the qualifications of the judges, as well as at what level they should be remunerated. So out of those 40 cases, I would say 26 judges manages what we call a senior, we refer to them as senior judges, the 26 of them. And then we have 14, which is review judges. The review judges, they form that panel of there has been, it's like a court of appeals, we can think of as civil court. So you have 26 of a regular military courts, and then we have 14 judges to the review of cases. Now, I'm mentioning this because when we started the year, we had only 12 judges from that were sitting. The judges are appointed for a period of 2 years. Every 2 years, they need to be reappointed. We had only 12 judges, but now in May the minister appointed 14 more judges, and right now also in October 14 more judges, another 12 judges were appointed. So all in all, we are now sitting with 26 judges. It's only now this month being a month of October, where I think as a Secretary of Defense I can now report that our courts are now sitting with a full bench. Our courts are now sitting with a full bench. In the presentation I'm dealing with slide number 5 on every Monday. And not that one, the other one. And the information that is not on the slide, I was just mentioning that the full court is about 40 judges, and when we started the year we didn't have the full appointees, and in May the minister appointed, and in October the minister appointed more judges, so now we don't have a full case. So now that will explain what you are seeing in that slide, slide number 5, that when we started in April, the cases that were outstanding were 2,220. And we went, the first case, this is the case of the senior military judges, MJ, that stands for military judges. And Nolle Prosequi, this is where the prosecutors say, this case we're going to prosecute. And then the next column will be addressing the cases that we received, and then the closing number of cases will be moved on to the next month. That's how we maintain our database. So you can see what we were referring to, that over the past 18 months we have had a backlog because we were behind in the appointment of judges, we were reviewing the policies, the qualifications and everything. So when we started the year in April, we said whereby in April there were no cases that were reviewed, and there was therefore only started reviewing cases in June. I mean cases, the court started sitting fully in June after the appointment of the judges. So we would then be reporting to say, yes, we have had challenges, but now, as you can see, we have now picked up So I think the month of August and September is reflecting that the cases that were actually finalized, about 150 cases there. And for the month of October, we're going to have more, because now the month of October, since the beginning of the year, is the first time that we have full judges appointed. So I think if the committee calls us in 6 months' time, we should report much more improvement, because now our judges, our military colleagues are fully functional. You can then see that as we are reporting now, we are sitting at 2,530 cases, and the cases that were said to, where the prosecutor said there is no crime such evidence, or these cases are not prosecutable, as it were, for the whole year has been about 82 cases, and we have this year alone received 848 cases. Some of these cases, of course, that needs to go to military courts, have to do most of them with the issue of discipline. So that is an overview of where we are with the military cases. Now I will go on to mention just to look at our legislative program. We have received information from the head of government, that is the Office of the Deputy President, indicating that we should limit the number of bills because of the limited time available for the bills. But between now and actually until March, we can only be presenting 2 or 3 bills. So these are the only bills that we have. The military discipline bill is still with the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. We have processed it as the department, and the Chief State Law Advisor raised some issues that we needed to be addressed in terms of to make sure that the military cases that were given about in military discipline and how we deal with military discipline, especially with the military justice, the two of them are aligned to our constitution. So that's what mostly has had a delay in the military discipline bill, but we hope that it should come out of the office of the Chief State Law Advisor soon, so that it can go to cabinet and come to parliament. The Defense Amendment Bill has been through cabinet, and now it is sitting on the schedule for Parliament to consider the Defense Amendment Bill. And the Hydrographic Bill is awaiting, I think, a time slot in cabinet, and then it will come to cabinet immediately. So I would say between now and March, if things were going according to our wishes, we would have liked to see all of these 3 bills in Parliament: Military Discipline Bill, Defense Amendment Bill, and Hydrographic Bill. Of those 3, the most significant one are the 2 ones, Military Discipline Bill and the Defense Amendment Bill. I think they are the ones who are likely to take. Because the Hydrographic Bill is really the update in terms of management of hydrographic vessels. This really deals with the issue of the mapping of our oceans to be used both by the commercial ships, and development of hydrographic maps for the oceans to be used both by the military ships as well as by the commercial ships. So that is the presentation that is around our legislative program, as well as the military court system. If it's okay, I will then go to the other presentation while we are at it, so that we can discuss all of them together. And this deals with the policy performance and the scope that I was covering, just to say that we do maintain a data sheet of the indicator, what's called the indicator leadership on policy performance. And from time to time, we present the status of these policies within the different forums of the department. And we produce a policy report, and both in terms of the DOE, that is the Secretariat Policy side, as well as the Defense Force Policy side, and then we get together in what we call PDS machinery for both Secretariat and Defense Force Military Command, where we then approve this deal. I'm just giving a background here in terms of how we manage them internally, in terms of the titles and then the methods of calculation, in terms of how far each policy is, whether it's 100% or it's less than 100%, depending on what phase it is. Phase one being the registration, phase two the development of that policy, phase three being functionally approved, that is the directorate in Fosterwood has approved it, and then from there goes through the various levels of corporate approval until then, as the Secretary of Defense has signed off on it. Most policies are signed off at our level, but there are certain things that goes to the Minister, and some others will need concurrence maybe with Treasury or with the Department of Administration. Now, I'm looking at the slide number 5, where I am now dealing with the policies that we are dealing with within the Department of Defense. Some of these policies might be new policies, but most of them are reviewed. Generally speaking, all policies need to be reviewed within a period of 5 years. Others might be 3, especially when it comes to dynamic ones such as IGs every 3 years, but most of them we review them every 3 years. The first one is the intensive policy. That one is almost done. In terms of in the draft, as far as the drafting is concerned, but by the time it reaches 40%, it means it should be getting ready. The directorate, that is Human Resource Division in this time, should be finishing with it so that it can start going through the various directors of the department. The human resource development policy status is also for review, but what is interesting about it is that each year we must submit a new plan to the Department of Public Service and Administration on human resource plan, what they call human resource plan. So the human resource policy is overarching and is now for review, and the process is the process of being reviewed. And the directive on the execution of the defense policy is also for review. It is 100% done. If I'm not mistaken, we should be ready to be signing off on that one as soon as it comes through the various forums of the department. And the same is with the defense international affairs policy. And these reviews most of the time are not major reviews, they are just reviews to make sure that they are up to date with, in this particular case, our diplomatic policy as led by GECO. And on slide number 6, we're still looking at the next policy, including number 5, which is the product in the City of Defense Policy Diploma. This will be various products that they need to be produced by our international affairs. Number 6 talks to the promulgated of acquisition of armaments in the DOD, DAP 1000. This policy is now complete. It just awaits the approval. It should be approved within this financial year. And also it was up for review. And the Defense Intangible Assets Management Policy is a new policy. We didn't have a policy on the defense intangible with our intellectual property. I think since we came in as within the Department of Defense as a South African Defense Force in our democracy, it was one aspect that was sort of lagging behind until the Auditor General pointed out that, you know, the Department of Defense has a lot of intellectual property through our development policy and through our research and development, working with CSIR, working with DNL and other defense industries. But that actually we didn't have a proper registry of the intellectual property that is now lying out there in the private sector, mostly in the defense industry. And the Auditor General said, where is your intellectual property policy? That's when we realized that actually the department didn't have intellectual property policy. So we developed it. It's now, actually we are ready. We are already applying research, already 100% developed, and it is being implemented. Maybe this update needs to be updated first. And the procurement then policy, the acquisition armaments deals with the armament acquisition, that is the weapons system, and the procurement policy deals strictly with non-armament, non-weapons system acquisition, procurement. And that policy is under review, still within the process. Number 9 on slide 7 deals with the compliance in the DOD corporate governance of ICT. All we are saying, this is almost like a new policy. Although we had the ICT policy, all that was an old ICT policy, and it was not aligned to the new government overarching ICT policy as promulgated by the Department of Public Service and Administration. So from the department, we had to come up with a new policy altogether regarding the DOD. I think this is one item that Auditor General has also been raising, that it needs to be fast-tracked, and I have personally taken one of ourselves, our office, that we must be fast-tracked, and it should be 100% very soon. The rest of the presentation, this is just a dashboard that we use for each and every directorate to say how many policies are lying waiting for it to be revised, and how many they need to be promulgated, and sort of to give everybody a warning. I won't go into details. And the others is just to now give the listing for a quick review in terms of where we are with the policy. So, Honorable Chairperson, that will be our presentation both on the issues of the military court cases, systems, administration, the issues of the legislative program that is that we're working on as the Department of Defense, as well as the issue of the status of policies within our department. Thanks very much, Chair.
Thank you, SecDef. Honorable members, over to you. Honorable Gamede and Honorable Mare, you'll follow, and Honorable Nisi, in that order.
Thanks to the Secretary for the presentation. On the third presentation, we appreciate that now you have heard the same full appointment of the judges. But in order for us to move forward, what were the reasons for non-armed appointment for such a long period? Was that cause the delay? Now, and secondly, if you have identified those risks, what actions have now been taken so that this does not occur again? Now, we know that it takes 2 years for these judges to serve. Do we have a proper now system structure that come the end of the term, automatically we don't have a gap? So that we don't ask you this question again about the backlog. And in your assessment, the other question, what are the major causes for indiscipline among the soldiers? And if you have identified them, how do you learn to arrest them? Those major causes. So that if we have one former minister, the one said, he gets worried when we have budget and increased budget for building prison instead of minimizing people to go to prison. So it's the same here. If you correct the discipline, would have minimum cases. So are we on that spot right now? On the second presentation, I'm worried about the slide 10, policies awaiting corporate approval. More especially, the one that deals with creditor payment. It also deals with the steady paying supposed payment, and also the transformation management policy. Because we cannot be talking really about transformation, we want it to happen. If those policies are still awaiting approval, can you give us some time frame on those? Because they are about our future in our country. Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. Apologies for late arrival. Chairperson, thank you, Secretary, for the presentations. On a first presentation, can I just get a confirmation from you, those judges that have been now been appointed, are they, what is their status, are they, if I can use the phrase, employees of the department, are all of them, or are some of them on a contractual basis from outside, or are some of them, you know, being used on an ad hoc basis from outside? So do I just can know, you know, how sustained is this appointment, and whether that will stick. Can you, obviously, because of all these delays, I think many of others have picked up that there's this kind of a reluctance within the department and in the defense force to charge people who then say that nothing happened. What plans have you put in place to actually communicate that and to make sure that people who are supposed to be charged get charged? Because I mean, you know, your numbers might come down, but if the actual cases on the ground of ill discipline proceeds, then the lot stays. So that is just very important for me to find that out. On the second one, if I could start with, in terms of all the policies, can I get a confirmation that these policies, you know, will be accessible for us to have a look at? Because I mean, it's good for us to see, you know, all these names, but sometimes you have to see the devil in the detail with regards to those policies, and only then we will be able to see whether it will be in support of a broader strategy and plans for the department. For instance, on that second one on page or slide 5, human resource policy, to what extent is that aligned with the requirements of restructuring and repositioning and bringing HR down to 40% of the budget? Do they speak to each other, and do they support each other? Otherwise, it might be totally opposing poles that we are talking about, and it will not help us eventually. On the that slide 6, that policy number 6, the acquisition of armaments. We've had the presentation the other day from Arms Corps, and they raised major concerns with regard to the ability of the NEL to be able to supply what the Defence Force is requiring. Now, it's good to have a policy, and that's why I say the devil is in detail. what does that policy say with regards to the relationship with Arms Corps and the NELS and other organizations or suppliers of armaments? Because then only we will know whether that policy can be implemented and support a broader strategy. On the IP, I'm glad that you mentioned about a register, because that has also been mentioned about by Arms Corps about their, they've used the phrase that billions rands of worth of IP in the NEL itself, and then also in other arms industry organizations. I mean, that's a huge task, it's a huge risk. Do the other companies and the NEL admit that IP belongs to the department, or to what extent is it? Are there agreements with regards to the use of the IP? Because we do not want to find ourselves where an organization like the NEL might be trading internationally, and even, I mean, we know if you look at their structure, they've got many subsidiaries and partnerships like the NEL Asia, Laser, and all the others, and they might trade with that IP as if it is theirs. So what guarantees and assurances and agreements do you have in place to make sure that those IP stays the property of DOD and the nation itself? That in itself will also, I mean, to what extent are you in contact with the NEL, in touch with the NEL with regards to protection and delivery on our IP? And that asset register, if I can use that phrase, that asset register on the IP, to what extent is that available also to us?
Also with the progress being made and not being finalized. the result is, of course, more and more cases are being added. I'm looking at the caseload. The last item was not calculated. It's actually standing at 3,299 as of September. So although we're dealing with cases, the backlogs are only increasing because they're not sufficiently dealt with. So the other question that will arise then is, will there be extra or extended hours or after hours or weekends be used by these judges to also deal with cases? And when cases are dealt with, depending on the nature of the case, what are the financial implications? Are people on suspension, on paid leave, while they're being investigated? At a huge cost to the department, and there's actually no person filling that position. So we have no person working, but earning money. And a case that is being thrown out because there's not enough judges or time allocated. Because I'm looking at the load, and the load is just increasing. So there's financial implications. We'd like to know exactly. And the nature of the cases, I do understand one of the key issues, discipline. But what is the nature of other cases? Is there fraud, corruption, other issues that we're not aware of? If that can be added further, the other nature of cases that is being dealt with. The other one, of course, is I think the issue was also raised. Normally when there is no effective law in place, it's also part of the neighborhood watch, sometimes the police just refuse to open a case. They don't give a docket, they don't take the person, is kept there, finished, and they just release the person. Because they say, the person is just going to waste our time, we're going to write up a report the whole night, we're leaving in the morning at 6, we need to get done. Is there such instances of the OCs not fulfilling their duties and responsibilities because the disciplinary bill is not in place, and therefore I'm just creating work for myself? Now, we've got that experience that it does happen. Is this the case where people are neglecting? I reported the case also of Youngsfield, where a person was walking around drunk on the facility. It was reported several times. No action was taken against that person. And he wasn't found drunk once. And it happens when he's on duty as well. The committee visited that site. We had reports about the people. So we know that that had happened, and no consequences were actually introduced there. The other one, of course, the hydrographic bill, we understand, it's the mapping, etc. We do know that those vessels are also online. And they're supposed to, the new vessel is supposed to be also procured. So I think that is all online. So I'm not sure exactly when this bill will be processed and the urgency of it in terms of what the requirements are. Because normally when we introduce the bill, we look at financial implications and the skills or expertise that's required. If we say the mapping is by the commercial, and it has an impact on the commercial side, is there any other, besides the Defense Department taking the responsibility, are there other partners outside or other stakeholders that would also participate in this, in the mapping, etc., to assist the department? The Defense Amendment Bill, I believe there are changes, but I'd like to ask, are there further changes anticipated? Otherwise, we're going to make amendments now, and then we have to further amend the Defense Bill. Now, one of the issues that is not on the table, which was raised in our discussion with Arms Corps about the IP, that there's an IP Act in place now, and that has a serious impact on the IP of the defense, because in essence it says that those who actually develop and manufacture, they become the owners of the IP, which is contrary to our understanding of royalties and the ownership of IP. Now, a policy is introduced, policy number 7 in the presentation speaks about the IP issue. Is a policy sufficient to supersede the IPR Act? Or is it necessary to amend the Defense Act and indicate that the Defense Act, the Defense IP, supersedes any other act or the implications of it? So the ownership of Defense IP will remain regardless of who manufactures and develops the IP. So I just want to make sure if the legal side of defense has investigated that matter and if that is part of the amendments to be considered. That's why I say if the amendments are on the table and that is not included, can that be included? Honorable Chair, I think what we should also have is, we've heard the report from the Secretary of Defense, and I think it's important that this committee be briefed by the state law advisor exactly of the status of the disciplinary board. We've heard about it being there with the state law advisor and been there for a long time. And I think we need to engage and ask what exactly is the problem and why cannot be resolved. There were a few issues raised, but I don't think those are issues that can actually delay the vote. So I would strongly advise from our side that we actually engage with the state law advisor on these issues. Maybe the Defense Act is one, but also disciplinary, all other bills that affect defense. If they've been forwarded to his office or her office, then we'd like to know what is the status of it and how far is this pre-certification that needs to be considered before it is tabled. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Over to you, Secretary.
No, thank you very much, honorable members. Just to apologize for General Matila, who just joined us now, because of the delays that we had this morning coming from the airport. General Matila, while you are taking yourself in, I'm putting to you now, giving you time to prepare to answer the difficult questions. And leave the good ones for me. As far as
you might just leave
it out. Members want to know on your just why you're preparing to answer. You see, when you talk about cases that land in the limited court justice, if you can give us just the categories of these cases, what cases are you giving me? The numbers are there on the slide, you have seen it. And also, I've indicated that there has been a period of 18 months where I really felt that we were not moving. But the plans have been put in place, judges have not been appointed, things are moving. And just also talk to that, what were the issues that we're not moving for the past, the delays, what caused the delays, and what plans have been put in place to get the delays. Then after that, maybe I will run up. But if you can just prepare as well as answering the other questions, maybe just see what that's about to deal with. Also, why I'm getting so many cases, I mean, thousands and thousands, I mean, the issue of the OC's responsibility, somebody drunk on duty and not actually taken any of the cases. What is it that is? To say that, as the Honourable Kamete said, you know, what are we doing really to prevent is so that we don't end up with such a backlog. Rather than to say, let's build more prisons, what are we doing to stop prisoners, to stop the increased number of prisoners? If we can just prepare along those lines. Thank you very much. Honourable Kamete, I would just start indicating that, as I said, General Matila will deal with the reasons for non-appointment of delays and the action that you are taking to put the systems in place. And also, I think he will highlight on the other his own observation in terms of what causes all of this discipline. But from where I'm sitting, the major cause of this discipline is that I feel like our commanders are not taking responsibility of their duties to discipline the members, to make sure that the members are disciplined. Most of the time, we have to be going in from Pretoria to Southern Town to Matuba, to all over, to Devon, to deal with a case of the discipline that should have been dealt with the commander on the spot. So what's happening to our military culture and our responsibility is a question that I'm putting. Yes, sometimes they come in and say the military discipline being, as Honorable Sons indicated, that is sitting in the system now since 2011, which is more than 6 years. Honorable Sons, not that it has not moved. It's moving, but at what pace are we moving? And, I know I'm going all over the place answering the questions, but if they are related, I would clap them together. I like the idea of saying the portfolio committee must engage with the Office of the State for Advisor, especially on these military discipline bills. When you engage with them, I think the chair can determine, consult, and see what is the best time. But any time is a good time when you give the time available to the committee. And that. Because the bill is sitting there, it has been there, and I thought it's back to us, but it has gone back to them again, because other issues have been raised. But mostly, it's all the issues of the military judge, as well as the civil judge, trying to put the military justice to be the same as the civil justice. It cannot be. Otherwise, if you say you must treat the military justice the same way you treat the civil justice, the way you treat the civil justice, then there's no need for the military justice, as far as I'm concerned. That's why you want the military justice separate, different from the. And then the question, of course, that the Constitution is an overarching law of the country. No one would come in and say the military justice should not be aligned to the Constitution. It has to be aligned to the Constitution. If there is something that needs to be done in the Constitution to cater for the military courts, this company, then the members of parliament are the lawmakers. And they are the ones who will look at that and advise. We are here to implement what is the constitution and what is the law of the country in terms of the military justice. So we do need assistance with the military. And I would like us to focus on that one. I wouldn't focus so much on the Defense Amendment. Defense Amendment is done. Important for the members to familiarize themselves with where it stands and how it is. But from where we are sitting, we are saying the focus of the portfolio committee must be on the military justice, on the military discipline. And the policy that are awaiting corporate approval, Honorable Kabaka, I'm very much aware and I'm attuned to it. Sometimes I do get a little bit frustrated by the process, but at the same time, is that before the police has been approved, when we are at the level of approval, sometimes I have a legal advisor, my legal advisor in office sitting next to me, I'm not going to pay him, but they do point out to say some of this is not aligned to what is coming through either from the National Treasury, the department dealing with the finance management and performance, or it's not coming through with what the future side of things in terms of the IT, or it's not aligned with what's coming through in the public service administration if it's related to later. So it when it's sitting in my office waiting for approval, it might just be that process, or it might be the process that one has searched back for them to look into it. But we're definitely aware, and our aim is really to limit it as much as possible without affecting the standard of the policy that we are doing. So we will pay, we'll continue paying attention to that honorable matter. Honorable Marae, when it comes to the status of judges, whether they're employees or contracts, I would say it's a mixture of the two, but now we're moving more and more toward the employees. During the period, but General Matilda would touch on that, General Matilda, your judges, are they employees or are they on contract? We have been depending also with the reserve force. They have clearly been an asset to us, because some of the reserve force members are experts. Some of them are in legal services, okay? They are running their own law firms, others they are lawyers by profession. So when you call a reserve force for such duties, we shouldn't say it's an outsource or it's a contract or it's a contract, because actually the reserve force come in as a member, it's called in as a member of the reserve force, so he's called in as an employee. I think I've succeeded to a very large extent when it comes to the lawyers. I'm still standing with the doctors. When I call the reserve force who are doctors, they still come in as doctors, contractors, and say, no, 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 we're here as an employee now. You listen to me now. So I'm going to pay you. Because this is at that level, this is how the employees are paid. But I think we're managing. John Matilda, the members are saying, charge those who need to be charged. People can't go around drunk and then not actually being taken. The policies that we have talked about, are they accessible to them? They should be. If I come across a policy that I would say is classified, I will mention it. I can't think of anybody in mind, but if I come across one, I will mention it. Because actually, most of these policies are supposed to be on our website. Are they on our website? The last time I checked my website, some policies were there, but they were old policies, and I was asking them to be removed because they were not up to date. That's just a challenge that I think most departments have in terms of updating our website. But what we are going to do, if you can make note of that, just put together all the policies and have them. We're not going to make copies. We're going to put them in the office chairman's office. When your office gets taken over by big five of UOD policies, please bear with us. We will deposit them there. And we'll find a way of putting them on the whiteboard. And each time, electronically on a disk. But let's start that work going, and then we'll keep you informed in terms of how far we're compiling all of those policies so that members can have access to those policies. And we'll talk about the HR policy alignment to the defense review of 40-40 case budget allocation. It's a little bit questionable whether the budgeting itself is gets into the policy, but the policy does, HR policy does speak to the reeducation of the defense force. That's what it is. When it comes to the budget allocation, we know that we are not at the 40-40 30 split that the budget allocation is supposed to. That we are engaging, and the National Treasury is interested in it, but to answer your question directly, no, the policy itself will not, you will not find a line, a policy guideline that says the budget must be Security, except to say that in our overarching policy document, a defense review, it addresses that, but the HR policy itself does not be speaking to the 40-40 safety budgets. Yes, we have acquisition, but acquisition policy is in place, being reviewed at this time, but the issue of PNL. To the capacity of the NL really to supply the requirements of the defense force, as I think indicated by council, continues to be a concern, and we as a department were committed to assist the NL in whatever way we can assist, because the NL is very critical for the capability of the South African National Defense Force. But unfortunately, on financial management, overseeing the level of financial management and performance management of the NEL. The NEL is really administratively reporting to the Department of Public Enterprises, as well as, of course, the National Treasury. That is the department mostly looking at overseeing the performance, both performance as well as financial management that is within the NEL. On our part, we can only commit to assist in whatever way that we might be able to assist. But the armament acquisition does relate to arms. So the armament acquisition will say, first of all, let the end user develop the requirements, specifications, everything, and let them say, this is what we require. Then after that, let them come to the office of the first year to say, what's the plan? We require it now, immediately, mid-term, long-term, and what's our budgeting, and then work with the office of the central for defense in terms of budgeting for the requirement. And once the budgeting for the requirement has been sorted out and planning for the acquisition has been done, then we hand over to AMSCO. Then we say to AMSCO, here is our requirement. We are working around our plans in this regard with this budget. You use your policies to go and acquire these armaments. And then after that, it's really off my office. Actually, I can even indicate that AMSCO report yes, made to our office, but they report to the Minister of Defense and Military Defense. The Minister appoints the board of AMSCO to run these acquisitions. So once I turn it over to AMSCO, really that independent process of AMSCO should be protected through this CEO, through this board, and reporting to the Minister. And I will only serve as an advisor to the Minister as far as the policy on armaments acquisition is concerned. The issue of IP register, let me we mentioned it in our presentation on policy. We are not there yet where we are to be honorable Marek. As we indicated, it's the first time that we have an intellectual property policy in the department. So now the Auditor General will indicate that a lot of work has been done, and they appreciate the amount of work that's been done to put together that register of intellectual property, intellectual property of the DOD. If I'm not mistaken, I think they are pretty much happy with the information that we've presented. But we still have challenges in terms of, to answer your question, will then the industry agree, or will there be disputes along the way? So far, our approach is that AMSCO is really delegated by the office to manage the IPs of the Department of Defense. And AMSCO is being capacitated. We have given AMSCO capacity. We might not talk about this very often, but maybe the portfolio committee needs to make it known to the South Africans that actually the capacity that is there for in AMSCO now is not just good for the defense, it's good for the country. It's actually available for other departments also to utilize. AMSCO has one of the biggest concentration of engineers in one state institution. I think going up to more than 100 engineers, in both mechanical and civil engineers that they have employed. And they are also building capacity of young engineers, both black and white, coming in from universities, being received by AMSCO's interns and also finally absorbed into the AMSCO force. And we rely on those engineers to be the ones who help us to ensure that our intellectual property is protected, serviced, properly serviced, and that it is not exploited without the Department of Defense benefiting from that. Up to now, I don't have any pain to show that this is what we have benefited from the intellectual and the Department of Defense from the IPs that we have developed. But the next, I hope the next Department of Defense will be able to report what they call generating revenues from exploitation of our intellectual property in appropriately designed agreements by AMSCO with the various defense units. And the issue of the IP Act is an issue for us. It's an issue that has not been resolved, and that maybe we would like the committee to remain seized because we that matter to see how we're resolving it and assist where possible. The IP Act simply says this. It talks about the intellectual property that has been developed by the government funding. this is kind of when the government funding. If I go and raise funds in wherever, in London or New York, as a company, I come in and do my project, it's fine. But what happens when a government funds a company or an institution to develop intellectual property for this and for that? The way it's stated in the Act is that that intellectual property does not belong to government. It belongs to the company, or it belongs to the service provider who has developed the intellectual property. I'm sure there was wisdom among the lawmakers, your colleagues, I would say, who made that law. They might have had wisdom when they made that law. The reason I think that they were covering that, they were thinking that we must give the private industry a chance to make money, commercialize and make money in terms of property. Because if I give you the money you make in terms of property, now let's say now you want to commercialize it. If you're going to commercialize it, then the money comes back to the government. You have no incentive to commercialize that, to make sure that you make money out of it. So, or to make sure that we grow the South African economy, let the SMEs out there who develop, who use our intellectual property, especially if you think about the money coming from the IGC and other government institutions, PIC, I don't know about PIC and others, let them give the opportunity so that they can benefit as SMEs, build the economy of the country. So that's, I think, what was behind the reasoning behind the lawmakers saying IP from government must belong from government funds, not belong to the service provider who developed that. But as you can imagine, then we are defending, and it's not working well for us. We had asked Minister, because the lead department is science and technology, Minister of Science and Technology, Minister of Defense, we have presented to both of them. There is a regulation that can exclude, that can provide an exemption for the Department of Defense. But as you know, it's not easy, because once you say give a Department of Defense exemption, then the Minister in terms of defense is going to feel like, if defense wants exemption, then nurses want to be agriculture wanting exemption, and then nursing is going to be water, nursing is going to be this is another department wanting exemption. So it's not easy to get exemption from any law that we have already developed in the past, but we are still trying to manage that situation through regulation. I think we need whatever help that we can get from the community to at least promote that regulation. I don't think there's more department asking for exemption from the law. Then, Honorable Nisi, since the defense review adoption, we then engage strictly to ensure that there are mechanisms for commanders to supervise the subordinates. Yes, I would say so. From the, now that we have raised the issue of defense review, although we are not, I mean, all the policies that we're talking about cover those areas, I just wanted to say, the most important thing come out of the defense review maybe is to monitor and provide oversight of our department will be to say, after the defense review, do you have now a defense secretariat status? Which is what I've asked for that. Now we need to have a defense secretariat status that will be aligned to the defense review. Even if it's not strategy has to be detailed, but a framework, defense secretariat, policy framework, or strategy framework that is aligned to the defense mission. And then the structure of the secretariat. Is the structure of the secretariat as it is today aligned to the defense mission? For me, that is the main issue. Although you are not going to get it as a one page, but all these policies that we're talking about now today, how are they aligned to the defense review 2015? And then the same thing on the military side. Do we have a military design and structure that has now been adopted or amended to be aligned in the SDB. Yes, these policies are supposed to be aligning the defense force structure and design to the SDB, but that's where really we need to be housing the discussion in terms of aligning our policies and strategies to the defense review. And General Chila, please, you talk about your military power because of your effort in extending them, and do you have sessions, military quarter on Sunday morning, to give you the effort, or are you planning to have military quarter on Sunday morning to give you your effort? And how are you managing the budget for the effort? Are you budgeting for the effort? Commits an obvious act of indiscipline and putting on suspension to continue paying and not the financial implications of it. And then into the nature of these cases. And when it comes to the hydrographic mapping, so I agree, the hydrographic bill is now coming to, is now on its way to Parliament, Cabinet, Parliament. I think there's a proposal to put it that should be part of the program. There was a debate whether the hydrographic bill and the hydrographic office of the hydrographer, national hydrographer, should be sitting in the Navy or it should be sitting in the Department of Transport. As we know, the military has really been the driver of many innovations and many achievements internationally. I think we all talk to that. But sometimes things are moving from the military now to towards the civilian space. So even when you look at the hydrographer, you might find that in some countries, the hydrographer is still sitting in the Navy, and in some countries, the hydrographer is now sitting in the Department of Transport, Civil Aviation, Civil Naval, and so on. Environmental. But at least for now, it's sitting in the Navy. And that's what the hydrographic bill says. And we have just approved that for commission. Acquisition of a hydrographic vessel, and the Navy has budgeted for it, and the hydrographic vessel is going to be built in Delhi, which is state-of-the-art technology. I think it's leader of, I don't know, 1.8 billion by financial budget allocation. So we have committed to move ahead within the Department of Defense. But if by the time it gets to Parliament, maybe the feeling is that it must go somewhere, then we'll be guided by the lawmakers in terms of that. But as of now, we work very closely with the Department of Transport. We have contacted on the hydrographic belt with the Department of Transport, with the economic cluster, with corporate widely. We have agreed that we will enter into a memorandum of agreement between transport and the defense. In terms of management of the hydrographic in the office of the hydrographic. So instruments will be put in place between us and the Department of Transport to make sure that that hydrographic processes are managed. I don't know whether you concur. He has been really driving with the hydrographic division for something widely, extensively. Department of Transport. I think I have covered that, General Matila, maybe you can cover those areas that we have asked you to cover.
My most profound apologies to the chairperson of the committee, for the committee and the members of the committee, and as well as my principal, our principal, the Secretary of Defense, which is very clear this morning. If I could proceed straight to the points raised by the honorable members of the committee as well as the Secretary of Defense, I am acting on behalf of the Adjutant General, Major General Dr. Ivan Nisi, who is out on a military exercise in the current week. And he requested that you stand in for him. If I could respond specifically to the issue of the military judges, and so this will relate to how these cases were accumulated, particularly the opening balance of cases in April in 2017, amounting to 2,220 cases. If I could take the members of the Honorable Committee to the positions in 2016, the assignments of the military judges are done in terms of statutes. That is the military discipline supplementary measures act of 1999. Now, the assignment that was given prior to the financial year ending 2016 April would have expired on the 31st of March 2016. Now, when it did expire, or the practice is, prior to expiry, submissions are made in the year before, in this case it would have been in 2015, for the minister to consider the extension of those assignments beyond April for a further determinable period as shall be indicated by the Office of the Minister. Now, what transpired in 2015 leading to 2016, as it expired 31st March 2016, the assignments of judges were not in place. They were not authorized to proceed with their work. Not because of any mishaps in the Office of the Ministry, but due to processes within the organization that is the SNDF, which I will explain now. As a result, the cases started accumulating now from April 2016 up to September 2016, when such assignments were not in place. The main reason for that was in relation to the new requirement to ensure that all military judges are also vetted. That is vetted by the Defense Intelligence. And as you know, and as Secretary for Defense will probably also take the point further, the vetting within the department, not only in the department, is a bit problematic because it is a scarce skill and there are challenges with the process. It is a process outside the division and it is mainly facilitated to the environment of intelligence. Now, all effort was engaged in ensuring that support is given, as well as support given by Defense Intelligence in ensuring that the judges are all vetted. And I can safely say by September 2016, 12 out of 19 of the existing functional judges were vetted. As a result, their assignment proceeded. Now, taking from there up to 2017, it had been difficult to finalize the remainder of the vetting process for reasons that to me are unknown. And obviously, that gap left by the seven odd remaining judges who were not functional is felt now through the statistics that were presented today. moving further on the requirements from the Office of the Adjutant General had been tabled and retabled for higher consideration to ensure that the numbers are increased in terms of the amount of judges, obviously partly to deal with the backlog, as well as to ensure that backlog does not accumulate in future, and to deal with current matters that are in existence. And it would suffice to say about two weeks or so back, the response from the Office of the Minister was very positive in that 42 new judges have now been assigned. But they are not fully functional yet, because some must be sworn in, and some obviously would have to complete the areas or functions within the areas where they were previously utilized in. In this regard also, two out of the 42, or a few, had been assigned purely for purposes of dealing with ad hoc matters that were still outstanding as at the 31st of March this year, in order to complete those matters. And two out of that, as SecDef indicated, are reserve force members. There is obviously a challenge with reserve force capacity because of the dwindling resources, and as a result, it is very difficult to utilize that capacity as we did optimally before due to the challenges of resources and the need to observe austerity measures within the department. 26 within this figure that I've given are full-time military judges. In other words, 26. Their primary purpose coming to work will be to preside over matters. And the remainder balance will obviously be part-time military judges to support on ad hoc basis when the needs and requirements arise, both within the Republic and outside the Republic. I must also hasten to say, when the new Adjutant General set in, who started with effect from the 1st of June this year, he then also, and that was part of the submission to the Office of the Minister, submitted that the Review Council, who are called Review Council in terms of the Military Discipline Supplementary Measures Act, who are in principle or will become, in terms of the pending Military Discipline Bill, review judges, have also been assigned, because essentially what they do is they do automatic review of cases that come from military courts to ensure that substantive and due fairness took place throughout the trial. Unlike in the civil or civilian environment, where a member or a person or an offender or a convict applies for a review of his case, in the military, all cases are automatically reviewable. And the member has an option also to table a request for appeal if there are grounds for appeal, which then goes to the Court of Military Appeals. The Court of Military Appeals, of course, there is profound support also from particularly the Judge President of the Gauteng Division, Justice Mlambo, Judge President Mlambo, who has made approximately six judges, between four and six judges available when the requirements arise for them to hear the appeals of the military cases. The last sitting of which was approximately 3 weeks ago, where two judges sat separately on this matter. That is Judge Mba and Judge Kubushi. The military judges, or perhaps to put it this way, there is a suffix in the military called PE, and there is a suffix called MC. That is after the first number. All these members are employees or members of the SNDF. the only difference is the ones with the PE suffix are more permanently employed in that their contracts do not have to be renewed, and those with the suffix of MC imply that on expiry of the contract term, which normally for them would have been 10 years, the member indicates his interest to renew his contract, and the department goes through due process to evaluate whether it is prepared to accept the contract renewal of such member. Initially, it starts from 5 years, and then it escalates to 10 years. So to answer that question, indeed, these are members, saving members of the SNDF, except for those, of course, that are BB, that are reserve force members. That we do not call them up necessarily doesn't mean they are out of the scope. When resources are available and when a need arises, resources permitting, they are called up for that specific purpose. But we need also to indicate that these are members of the legal profession outside who also have their practices to run. If I could just to round up that specific issue, particularly on the judges, it needs to be also mentioned that due to challenges experienced by the department, and probably if I'm at fault, the Secretary for Defense will rectify me, but when due to natural attrition or due to resignation or due to retirement, the military law practitioners like, and I will talk particularly about military law practitioners, do severe ties with the department, their posts are not filled up. Obviously, to bring the item 10 issue, that is the one on remuneration, back on par with the broader deficit within the department. So when that post gets vacated, whether it's a judge or whether it's a prosecutor or a defense counsel or a review counsel, that post will not be filled up. The only way we can maneuver around that is to possibly identify a candidate within those court statutory functional domains of who may be suitable to ascend to a specific responsibility, whether it be in prosecution or whether it be in the judge's domain. So that is just to explain the issue that as a result, we are not fully or functioning at full capacity. I may not be in a position to reflect on the figures right away, but I think our footprint is sitting at just around 366, if I'm not mistaken, 366 out of 446 posts available within the division. I have answered the question raised to say what was the reason for the non-appointment. The reason was the vetting issue, and that was purely the only reason, primary reason. The issue on non-electoral security and how it impacts on the aspect of discipline within the military. The non-electoral security decisions are taken by the Director of Military Prosecution within his independent functional responsibility upon evaluating cases flowing from, and I need to mention this to honorable members of the committee, from command level. Discipline issues are initiated by the commander. The military legal services entity is merely there as a tool to ensure that discipline is effected through attendance of such matters at military court. So whatever step that needs to be done is not initiated at the legal services division domain. It must, by practice and through custom, emanate from the commander's level. Now that is important for me to mention because if the honorable committee members will allow me, 415 cases. I am now adding up what was presented in the fifth slide under ECHO cases received in April 67, May 171, June 177, accumulating to 415. And I am ending there because between April and June this year again, the judges were not assigned and the courts were not functioning at all. So what happened in the meantime, the prosecutors supported the commanders, supported the military police in ensuring that investigations that are completed will be case-ready cases when the court resumes action later on as exercise. Now, that exercise would have unfolded as part of their daily duties, particularly the defense, rather prosecution counsel, and the military defense counsel, unless members opt for private legal representation, would have also supported that exercise to ensure that by the time the court starts, the cases are ready to go to court. Now, by the end of June, 415 cases, new cases, were received, in addition to the 2,220 that was the opening balance as at 1 April 2017. Now, this is how the backlog accumulates, because where in a period of 3 months where there is no action, visually to work on that which was available, which also came as a result of some other backlog, you are sitting again with a deficit to start with in addition to what is available. And that is why the amount would have increased by the end of June to 2448, except, as you would have seen, non-prosecute cases that director military prosecutions could finalize in May. That is not dependent on going to court, because he looks at the investigation and makes a determination there is no case to be taken to court. Similarly, in June, he could make a decision on 12 of those matters. He didn't have to depend on the court to do it. It was purely an exercise of his statutory function. But now the question is, how do this non-prosecute okay? What gives rise to this? There could be many, a myriad of reasons for that. It could either be because this was a frivolous action right from the beginning, from command level. Either the commanding officer, I'm not saying the officer commanding, commanding officer can be the next supervisor above that specific subordinate. It may be a corporal, it may be a sergeant, it could be a warrant officer. And before you get to the officer commanding, who is in charge of that specific unit. Now, in this instance, it's a personal difference between the two functionaries at the bottom, and the one who is senior decides to take action as a result of that. That exists in the workplace, and that the military would not be different to that. Others, it could be purely because either witnesses have passed on, or the main complainant has passed on, and the case may not necessarily be proceeded. Some of the reasons could be it's a matter that emanated from the deployment area. There are always complications surrounding witnesses outside the Republic, in which instance they have always put a demand to say, I will come and testify if you pay me so much. Otherwise, I'm not prepared to come and testify. It has happened in the Burundi, it has happened also in the DRC. In other instances, it could be poor investigations or lack of adequate investigations through the military police. But normally, that shortcoming is often remedied through the interaction between the allocated prosecution counsel who guides the military police official to fulfill a specific requirement. So there are many other reasons that possibly director military prosecutions can answer to if required, but normally those are most of the reasons that come through. The military retains jurisdiction over its members even after they have retired or resigned, provided the initiating process is taken 3 months or within 3 months after that person has severed ties with the organization. So the jurisdiction is not, unlike in the civil environment, it is not based on the area where you are, in a specific district or magisterial area or high court area. It is attached to you as a person because you are subject to the military discipline code. As a result, it is still possible to pursue matters even after members have completed their term or function within the organization. It is not often that easy, but also in other instances, other matters are referred to the magistrate court, especially where the military has lost jurisdiction over its members, either because the member was not arraigned before a judge within the period prescribed in the act, which would be 6 months in the case of a warning, or which would be within 48 hours in the case of an arrest. It does happen, such matters do pop up here and there, but in such cases, the director of military prosecutions through the police refers the case to the local magistrate court for them to hear the specific matter. But I must say also, the magistrate court may not be keen on listening to a disciplinary matter. For them, they are more captured by more serious crimes than the fact that someone disobeyed a lawful command. If I could then proceed also to the issue of extended court hours. Ordinarily, the court function on any given day, unlike with the magistrate court, we do not have a permanent military judge sitting at a specific court at this stage, where the cases run from Monday up to Monday with that court allocated to that specific judge. Because we have, due to the structure of the organization, we have to take our services to the environments where the matters are arising. As a result, there's a lot of extensive movement also among the available judges, where each region and each regional office of the legal division, we call them legal satellite offices, like the one in Cape Town sitting at the castle. It is also responsible for part of the Eastern Cape up to the Kei River, meaning their responsibility stretches up to Grand South. It stretches the entire Western Cape area. The one sitting in Durban ends up in Umtata, as an example. Now that means, in light of also the non-assignment of judges, that specific judge must move, available one in Durban must move from Durban, move to Umtata, to Ladysmith, to the area close to Richards Bay, Mutubatuba, as an example. So these are some of also the environmental factors that impact on effective utilization, because there's also movement between, unlike with the prosecutors and defense counsels who are co-located, with the judges, because of also the numbers, they have to move around. Certain matters must be also heard by senior military judges, either because of the rank that is involved, in other words, from the rank of major upwards. Those cases cannot appear in what we call a court of military judge. They must appear before the court of senior military judge. Now, the candidate who fulfill that function may only bear the rank of senior staff officer, that is a colonel, according to statute, in order to hear those specific matters. Now, obviously, given the limited number of those judges also, they have to service at the moment, before the assignment of the 42 judges or 26 full-time, what we had was, I think, two senior military judges who had now to run throughout the entire country and also go to Burundi or, I mean, to DRC to hear matters that arise externally. Two senior judges. But obviously the scenario has changed since about 2 weeks back. The issue of suspensions, there was a high court ruling, and the director legal advice may step in through the permission of SECDEF if need be, where the high court ruled that suspensions cannot be without pay. Suspensions under any circumstances have to be with pay so that the members of the family are not punished for the wrongdoings of the employee or member of the defense force. So we, as a matter of practice, although it is not administered by the legal division, it is a function administered by commanders. It is totally within their domain. The officers commanding to make applications through their channels of command up to the chief of the SNDF requesting for a specific member to be suspended. And the grounds for that suspension would be laid out, and obviously due process would be followed as prescribed in the Act, Section 42 of the NDSMA, as well as in regulation. Now, whether a member who is due to stand trial must or may be suspended, as I say, it is a matter that would be occasioned from the command level. And what the prosecutor would be told is that this member is currently suspended or application has been tendered for it or has suspension due to the circumstances. They cannot advise otherwise on that. What their primary function is to ensure that even if that member is suspended, their case go to court through necessary liaison. So that's how we relate with the issue of suspension. We nonetheless take those matters to court according to how the schedule would arise. Of course, the implications on those suspensions in terms of the matters that are protracted, to say the members are with pay, to the extent that we may be at fault in being part of the delay to the finalization of those matters, obviously we are subject to the wisdom of our principals, but it is our fervent determination and daily commitment to ensure that in accordance with the priorities that are set, amongst others, it includes members under suspension or members who are senior officers and so forth, criminal offenses, sexual offenses, and so forth. So the priority list of criminal, rather of cases that must be attended to is or emanate from the director of prosecution as an advice, obviously, to the adjutant general. In up to 2016 and between 2013 and 2016 in particular, a general officer who was supernumerary in the division was appointed to lead the task team to ensure that the backlog is maintained. In other words, it's eliminated. And he took retirement with effect from May this year. And he was then responsible with a backlog team appointed from various regions but co-located in Pretoria as well as in Bloemfontein, because these are the main areas where you have many military bases and where you have many soldiers in the area. And this was a team consisting of a mixture of reserve force capacity and permanent force capacity. The permanent force capacity, obviously, was taken from those specific regions to ensure that once the local teams deal with existing cases that arise on a daily basis, there's a team dedicated to handle the backlog team. And they were called the backlog project. And they functioned effectively until the 31st of March this year. But as I say, it was with a view of killing that backlog as it arose. And the new strategies have been devised now to move away from that, and then obviously to ensure that the backlog is captured. we do not have necessarily extended court hours as a daily practice, but the Adjutant General, the local representative of the Adjutant General, who are located in all regional offices, account on monthly basis to the Adjutant General what on the court hours utilized. They account too on the amount of cases completed. What are the glitches? And they account three on the budget or resource allocations to ensure that both on operational and personnel aspects, the budget is utilized according to the set target as reported to the office of the Secretary of Defense. Now, given that, courts do wait up to 5, 6 p.m. and there is no remuneration for extended court hours. It is a call of duty, which is normally attended. Court starts at 9 or before 9, depending on the area, and they can work up to the standard time is up to 4 o'clock, but they do extend beyond that time. Ordinarily, the courts do not operate, I thought, within the Republic on Saturdays, on Sunday, but as I say, in the deployment area, it is not unusual for the court to, in the period that it is there, whether for 2 weeks, to work up to 8, 9 p.m., because the soldiers are co-located in that base. The witnesses, the accused, even the judge and the prosecutors, all are within that specific military contingent area. That is why it is simple to facilitate those specific issues in deployment areas, whether internally or outside the Republic. If I could cross over to the military discipline. In 2011, the Defense Legal Services Division was mandated to revise the existing Military Discipline Supplementary Measures Act 16 of 99. If I could, just as a reminder, with the permission of the chairperson and the honorable members of the committee, the Act of 99 came as a result of the moratorium that was put in place when the previous court martials, general and ordinary court martials, were declared unconstitutional, and therefore the military justice dispensation had to be aligned with the Constitution. This occurred between 1997 and 1998, and very quickly the Parliament had to be approached to say, in the meantime, the Department has drafted this legislation and we request your attendance on it, and it was passed in May 1999. Now, it was called Supplementary Measures Act because it was foreseen that in future it may need to be revised, but in terms of the constitutional principles that led to its acceptance and certification, the constitutional principles were very much solid as well as grounded, in line with the mandate of the department to effect or ensure that the Defense Force is a disciplined and structured organization. And I'm saying this because the prosecution environment was challenged in the Kosale matter before the Constitutional Court, and it was very clear with regard to the role and function of a military justice system in a constitutional democracy. Having said that, over the years, within or internally, we identified certain things that may need to be refined, not that it is not working, but because it could be, as the honorable members of the committee would appreciate, the knowledgeable ones would always take advantage of certain gaps that are there and show you the lacunas that are there in your legislation. Because obviously it was hurried and it had to be facilitated to meet the objectives at the time when it was enacted. But I hasten to say, without contradicting what my principal has said, that it does not mean the system is dysfunctional. It is very much functional. The only challenge is, do the commanders utilize it to the best of their capability? Even today, if I were to say it was utilized to the best of those abilities, the answer is likely to be no. This is in spite of the requirement to refine what is in existence and to make it a better piece of legislation. And may I hasten to say, the mandate of the Military Command Council and the Plenary Defense Staff Council in 2011 June was to add up those elements that would assist the commander in ensuring that the structure is indeed disciplined. I am saying this because, amongst others, a chapter was brought in, chapter 24, then it has since been removed, on administrative processes, which would have managed the day-to-day issues that the challengers, rather the commanders are challenged with or faced with and they need to facilitate to ensure that the organization is disciplined. Then in 2012, the first draft was submitted to the Office of Chief Legal Advisor in Cape Town, the ensuing discussions emanated in 2013, where the department was in daily contact, had it not also been for the physical contact that we maintained in the office over the office of OFLA to ensure that the bill is taken forward. Now, in 2013, those consultations were extensive, and a comprehensive bill was then resubmitted back to them in 2014, November 2014. Their first opinion came in 2015 in February, vis-a-vis that bill that was forwarded to them, to which opinion the department responded by March that specific year. We awaited their second opinion, but I must say also we appeared before the portfolio committee, I believe it was the 18th of March, with Secretary for Defense 2015, to update the portfolio committee on the work done until that stage. Then other interfaces took place, but in 2016, around about February, we only became aware of the second opinion, which OFLA said they prepared in July 2015. And it was at that time that we also prepared another comprehensive response to their second opinion. But we physically also came with the then Adjutant General, Major General Mono, to the office of OFLA to discuss the issues which emanated from their second opinion, their first opinion, and to clear the breaches which they projected in their opinion. Most of the issues raised were their constitutional concerns, drafting issues, and so forth, and we believe we answered all constitutional issues which they raised to say there's a place, like Secretary for Defense said, a place for a unique justice system called the military justice system. And issues such as your institutional and individual independence may not have to be looked at as they are with the judges of the Constitutional Court, for instance, as it is with the High Court judges. And I say this mainly because, say, the preponderance of legal jurisprudence, both international and domestic, to point out to the fact that the lower courts are often protected by the High Court. That is inherent in the powers of the High Court. And the military courts do not project to be of a status beyond that of the High Court or High Court. They are at that level of district and magistrate court. The only difference is the civil courts do not have jurisdiction outside the Republic, neither any court within the Republic and the military court, as it is international custom, do have jurisdiction outside. Otherwise, our members who go outside the Republic may have to be subjected to the at times harsh legal dispensations, some which are unilateral, some which are very punitive outside the Republic. It is purely to protect them as citizens of the country and to as ambassadors of the Republic. That said, in 2016, we therefore moved for the pre-certification of that comprehensive bill, and it was done in May, I believe it was the 6th of May 2016. Immediately thereafter, the division engaged the development committee of the Justice Crime and Security Rather Cluster, and the Security Cluster referred us back again to the DEVCOM Development Committee to say, engage at that level, clear it up as it is legislative procedure, and then approach us when you are done. I may indicate that one such first of those consultations took place on the 16th of May 2016, if my memory is still sharp on that, and the chairperson guided us on what needed to be done by the department before the next engagement. We went back, we had certain responsibilities, and by August that year, we provided all jurisprudence that there were, or responses that they required of us to TIRA, because they were more concerned with, although they took note of the certification by the Office of Oxlack, their specific remarks that we noted the generality of the pre-certification, but they were still not satisfied with certain constitutional issues and wanted the Department of Justice to come on board, for instance, the Office of the Chief Justice also to come on board with regard to those specific. And how we remedied that was also through the Office of SecDef to issue out letters together with areas in the bill that affected that specific department, in addition to the entire bill, that we gave out to all state departments that are stakeholders affected, obviously, or that would be affected by the military discipline bill. These letters went out by the last week, beginning of July, and by August, two or three had already responded, but I may also indicate that by February this year, not all departments had responded. This is notwithstanding our return to the DEVCOM on two more other occasions in 2016 as a matter was tabled before then, and as our principals required us to make sure that we sing the note in their ear to ensure that this bill is pursued. In spite of those appearances, there were these comments that were still outstanding. And up to this stage, I believe it could be only two or so departments, but those that had been received had been consolidated with a view then of completing the draft SAYAS process to meet other requirements. That said, Chair, there was obviously a transition of authority in this year. That is, at the beginning of June, as I said, Major General Nisi took over from Major General Mono. And among immediate issues that he attended to, or which he instructed on, as obviously instructed by the department, but mainly as arising from some of the concerns that the SLA, State Law Advisor, had raised, they wanted us now to separate the bill. They said it's too comprehensive. It consisted then of about 26 chapters. And the rules were intertwined with the substantive. So it wouldn't have provided for rules separate from the substantive. What would have been regulations was also intertwined. But now the issue there is that was our mandate from right from the beginning, to say it should be a one-stop solution for all the challenges that the commanders are facing on the ground. And that where now the challenge came through, because the Office of the Chief Stable Advisor matches those that are assigned up would have dealt with it within their competence. I guess the members of the Portfolio Committee would appreciate that they may not necessarily have also military background. And that complicates issues, because as said, they said, they do not understand the difference between commanding officer and officer commanding. For them, it's either one of the two, because it doesn't make sense. It's almost a term of the same connotation.
General.
Just as an example.
General. General. I'm going to ask you to wrap up.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
Having said that, to the committee, the where we stand, sir, the bill has been separated. The substantive, the rules, the regulations have kind of been separated, although also it was a hurried process. It has since been set with the state law advisor on the 25th of July. It was given to the DEFCOM as a result of the DEFCOM of 20 July. It was given to the Office of OFLA for pre-certification in the current mode, where it separated the substantive rules and the regulations will be dealt with later. So the OFLA attended also on the department with the director legal advice on the 24th of August to clear those issues that seem to be problematic. And there was also a follow-up visit by the Adjutant General to the Office of Chief State Law Advisor in Cape Town now in September to clear off some of the issues that they raised as a result. As we stand currently, it is awaiting pre-certification and in order to effect the next other steps that should unfold. That's where we stand. I'm sorry for the fact that you don't know whether I...
There will be time to think it.
No, thank you very much, General. In conclusion, honorable members, what we are saying is that yes, despite the challenges, we do have successes to report as far as the issue of military justice. As you know, our soldiers have been cited as one of the group of countries that have been affected by the CIA cases in our deployment in the DRC, peacekeeping operations in the DRC. That is the sexual exploitation and assault cases, and being actually cited by the UN itself. But the UN has come, we provided a full report in terms of how we're managing those cases. And they appreciated the fact that South Africa is the only country from all the peacekeeping deployed countries in the DRC or anywhere that has military courts on the ground. No other country has military courts running in the peacekeeping areas deployed except South Africa. And that helps us to address cases such as the CIA cases. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm running to another meeting. What is it, honorable?
Questions that were not answered.
Okay. You'll respond to them in writing.
Yeah, could I just raise a quick question, honorable chair? The one is the issue of the financial implications that wasn't given.
Okay.
So wherever it resides, we need to get that information and quantify it. The other one is actually also, we want to know the average duration of cases and the longest case and the cost attached to the longest case that's been running with the department. Then of course, going ahead, honorable chair, is that if we employ 42 military judges to deal with all these cases, there will come a time that, of course, because of the discipline bill being in place, military judges being in place, that we may require less military judges. So everybody cannot be employed on a permanent basis, as will then be some of them on contract basis and others will be retained. And of course it gives one the opportunity to re-employ people if others leave. Just a response on that one, how that has been planned, the strategy of employment, and to accommodate that. I think those are the issues that we'd like to raise. The last one is, of course, when soldiers are found guilty and convicted of sexual cases or harassment or rape or whatever, what is exactly the consequence of that? And are they blacklisted? Are they dishonorably discharged, never to join the army again?
Yeah. Thank you very much. You'll give us written responses for that, ne? I think we are done, honorable members, with this presentation. The minutes have been circulated to yourselves. Is there any amendment? Can we have a mover for the adoption? You move, honorable Isau. Second up. I want a second up for the honorable Gamede. Thank you very much. Our meeting is adjourned.
The issues are covered in the BRRR.
So
most of it covered there.
In the minute.
Yeah, in the BRRR.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, good.